Lecture 20, The Problem of God. In our lecture series, we have been considering some of the problems that contemporary natural law theory must face. Things like question of evolution, things like cultural relativism. Today I'd like to take up yet one more topic in that particular line, namely the question about religious commitment. Whether natural law is a religious philosophy, whether natural law necessarily presumes belief in the existence of God. The existence of a natural moral law does at least seem, prima facie, to suppose the existence of a lawgiver. How can you have a law without someone who promulgated that law? And I suppose it's for this reason that many religious traditions have sensed some kind of very deep-seated compatibility between a basic natural law ethics and their own beliefs. And yet, there have been a number of thinkers in various traditions who have not made this particular connection. One thinks of Aristotle, for instance, whose God is just so remote and distant and doesn't seem to play much role in his explicitly ethical writings. One thinks of the Stoics in antiquity, who had a sense of a cosmic God, but it's a very pantheistic sort of universe. It's not a personal God. In the early modern period, one has figures like Grotius, whom we discussed, who at least raised the question, wouldn't there still be a natural law even if there were no God? And then there are some explicit atheists who are natural law thinkers. I consider in particular Ernst Bloch, the Marxist, to be one of those who is explicit in his denials of the existence of God and yet is a natural law thinker in many respects. On the other hand, there are some thinkers for whom the very existence of the natural law is something that demonstrates the existence of God. Cardinal Newman is one of those whose argument for the existence of God from conscience seems to work in just the opposite direction. So what we do well, I think, is to consider for this lecture period various questions pertaining to religion and natural law. I'd like to divide up our time in this lecture, first considering just the nature of the questions, because it's a very complicated issue, I think. Secondly, I'd like to propose a distinction between the way in which natural law is grounded itself, as opposed to what we must know about the natural law and about its ground. And I think the God question is relevant there. And then thirdly, I'd like to consider some of the ramifications of this set of positions. First, then, just some general questions about how God is related to natural law theory. Some of the questions that are raised pertain to the reality of the matter, whether there is a God. So, for instance, we could ask, does natural law obligation rest upon there being a God who is the source of the obligation? What if there is no God? Is there still natural law? I think that's the first set of questions. And that's a set of questions dependent upon how the reality is. But there's a second set of questions about one's knowledge of all this. And one could ask, for instance, suppose a given person doesn't believe in God. Now, that's separate from whether there is one. We're now talking about the subjective side. The person doesn't believe in God. Can there still be a knowledge of natural law, or at least of objective morality for such a person? Or what if the person is not in the state of actual disbelief, but rather is more agnostic and seeking and searching? What if a person just doesn't know about God? What will be the likely stance as regards the natural law? Or, finally, with questions of knowledge and questions of the subject, what if you have two people in a discussion, or several, who have different assumptions about God, about what kind of a God there is, or how active and involved this God might be? What is the relation of that to natural law? It seems to me, in the study of this subject, that there is absolutely no doubt that there is some sort of connection between the problem of natural law and the problem of God. But I think it really is difficult to establish exactly what connection there is. The way I'd like to discuss this is to ask you to think about direction. Some of the thinkers in our survey, some of the thinkers like to move from morality to God. Others, on the other hand, like to move from God to morality. And I think that will help us at least divide the question. First, is the study of morality and the study of natural law a way to come to know that there is a God? Or does one already have to know that God exists before one can show that there is such a thing as a really binding and obligatory natural law? The first figure I would consider with you is John Henry Cardinal Newman, who was a great British thinker in the end of the last century. And he certainly preferred the route of going from morals to God, that the acquaintance we have with objective morality is something that will give us a reason for thinking that there is a God, even if we're unable to establish the existence of that God philosophically in any other way. The argument here is that we might very well come to a sense of moral duty, a sense of moral obligation. But for that moral duty and that moral obligation to be entirely and completely and absolutely true, there's got to be someone to whom we are obliged. Let me read a short passage from his book, A Grammar of Assent. He says, "If, as is the case, we feel responsibility, if we are ashamed, frightened at transgressing the voice of conscience, this implies that there is one to whom we are responsible, before whom we are ashamed, whose claim upon us we fear." And from that point, Newman goes on to try to make his argument for the existence of God. Other thinkers, however, starting from that same position, namely the fact of conscience, the inescapability of moral obligation, others come to a very different stance on whether or not we must then come to a knowledge of God. Immanuel Kant, whom we were discussing a few lectures ago, is one of these. He holds that we can indeed be very, very certain about the nature and strictures involved in morality, but he is so insistent at the same time that we can never transcend the realm of space and time to a spiritual or transcendent entity, that we can still not rely upon there being a God on the basis of our morality. Rather, we must postulate such a God. And so he is famous for the theory of postulatory theism, saying, although we can't know for sure that there is one, we must live as though there is one. And so it's a philosophy of the as-if. But in just the opposite spirit, the existentialist Jean-Paul Sartre contends that we have to be postulatory atheists because of morality. His idea, I disagree with it strongly, but it's only fair to represent it. His idea is that the very existence of a God would compromise our freedom, would compromise our liberty, because it would restrain and restrict and confine human autonomy to a set of external standards in such a way that he thinks that we could never be adequately free. I'll return to that question of freedom a little bit later in this lecture series. Many theorists, on the other hand, I would say the mainstream with regard to natural law thinking, would hold that we should really proceed in the opposite direction, not from morals to God, but rather from the existence of God to morality. And in so arguing, they think that it is necessary to clarify what sort of God this is. Those figures who have a sort of an impersonal cosmic deity, not in any way loving or just, come to a certain stance with regard to justice and virtue. Other figures think that we must start from God and know that this God is a personal God, that this God is someone who is truly loving and deeply concerned, and that that makes a difference for how the nature of morality is set up. Thomas Aquinas, for instance, who we've been citing throughout our series, is very much inclined to a personal notion of a God who has created the world and loves this world, and he thinks of natural law very distinctively as our human participation in God's own providence, that God who set up the world and set up all the natures of things within the world, each one having a natural directedness toward their end, similarly has given us human beings a nature with an end-directedness to which we are naturally inclined, and yet we share even more deeply in God's own loving and providential and personally directed plan by having personal intelligence ourselves. For us, it's a matter of sharing in the work of divine providence by coming to realize what the natural law is, thinking out how to get to this end, and not just thinking it out for ourselves, but being immediately responsible for our families and for our communities, even for all mankind. One thinks of Aquinas' own great source in the matter of ethics, which is as frequently Aristotle as it is the Bible, And one sees in someone like Aristotle, a thinker who has a notion of God, who has a notion that natural law is as eternal as God is, and yet his God is so distant, so cool. Aristotle's God is pure mind, and mind not thinking about the world, but mind thinking about itself, only concerned with thinking about the very best object. In a way, this is part of the reason why the sage for Aristotelian philosophy has as his own natural end pure contemplation, and only secondarily the world of action. There are, however, a number of natural law thinkers who fall in the category of thinking that the question of God and the question of natural law are simply utterly separate. Hugo Grotius, I suppose, falls into this category, for he was the one who, at the beginning of the modern period, very mindful of ecclesiastical debates and for separation of the churches, thought that perhaps natural law would be a wonderful way for reconciling these religious divergences and finding practical ways to work at social harmony. And at one point in his book on the right of war and peace, on the law of war and peace, he writes, "What we have just said about natural law would still hold, even if we granted that there is no God, or that he is not concerned with human affairs." There you have a thinker who is not denying the existence of God. In fact, I think he's a very God-fearing man. He simply thinks that morality is independent of the God question. The ancient Stoics, in a way, are sort of in this category, for although they have a God, the God is so impersonal, their system so pantheistic and so deeply material, that there is no particular relevance that the God has, except that he's part of the system, and that somehow our own moral living and use of our reason is a participation, a seeking of harmony in this divine system. But one could do the thought experiment and ask what difference it makes in practice. And then finally, as I mentioned in the introduction, there are a number of contemporary Marxist theories, and this might be a little surprising because we don't tend to associate natural law with Marxism, except when we think back to the way in which Marxism invariably tends to think of the nature of the entire species. They would consider, at least in their pure theorists, they would consider human nature to be the decisive category because you're thinking of species being rather than thinking of individuals as having the greatest worth. And for Ernst Bloch, religion is simply one of those tools by which there is oppression of the weak by the powerful, and that natural law instead is part of the way to rescue this by remembering what the nature of the species is. He writes about this in a very interesting book called Natural Law and Human Dignity. Another group that I should mention here briefly to conclude this part of the survey are the people who want to urge that one cannot get to a natural law ethics at all, but rather that one must look to God as the source of morality. So instead of someone like Aquinas, who thinks that these are overlapping sources who both can give you the same insight, whether the insight about morality comes from God or whether the insight about morality comes from nature, there are a number of figures for whom it is not possible to get from God to a natural law claim, but rather one must depend upon God for a set of divine commands, that this is the only realistic and reliable source of moral obligation and our only source of knowledge of those moral obligations. The two or three books that I've seen come out in the last 2 years on this try to make that case that God is the source of our obligation, and yet it's interesting to me that a work like John Keats or some of the other theorists who've tried divine command morality actually come down to something very close to natural law morality in the way in which they depend so heavily upon the way God has established humankind and therefore given appropriate laws. It's God, almost God conforming himself to human nature for the expression of these divine commands. Well, after that survey, let me turn more to the philosophical problem. Namely, I think that we can make some progress by making a careful distinction between the natural law and how it is grounded, what it really rests on, as opposed to how we know what natural law is grounded on. So the second part of the discussion there is about what our knowledge contributes to this and how our knowledge is obtained. In my judgment, there are simply irresolvable problems and internal contradictions within some of the positions I named above, in particular the Stoics and the Marxists. So I regard them as insufficiently attentive to this distinction and unable really to meet its demands. Stoic materialism, for instance, seems to me to be unable to provide an adequate philosophical explanation for how we're free, let alone an adequate explanation of how there can be moral responsibility because of that freedom, and not just the pragmatic counsel of wise people in the community. That is, the problem is, in any materialist system, how do you ever account for something being free? A materialist system is one in which there is complete determination, complete causal determinism, so that the material things in the system are causing other things in a very closed system. And what freedom requires is that there be something that is not caused by a causal chain exterior to the being we say to be free. So I find an internal contradiction in the Stoic system, an assertion of freedom, but no grounds within a philosophy that is completely materialist for managing this, let alone how there could be a God who's outside the system, and of course for Stoicism there is not. Likewise, in the system of atheist Marxism and their versions of natural law, when we find such natural law versions in thinkers like Ernst Bloch, there are recurrent problems that face any ethical naturalism. Here, beyond the mere problem about materialism, which is, again, insuperable, I think there's also a problem in a system that is atheistic. How can there ever be a law without a lawgiver? At that point, I think you would have vastly transformed the meaning of law and would have been taking the meaning of law to be simply our record for how things normally work. We are stating it in some law-like version, but at that point there isn't a source of real obligation that you can respond to or fail to respond to. There rather is an effort to codify and an effort to describe what it is that people normally do. But that isn't enough for natural law purposes, precisely because natural law purposes deal with those who obey the law and those who disobey the law. And when we're dealing with natural law, the claim is not that we've got a statistical majority in favor of the option that we're naming as normal, but rather we're claiming that there's something intrinsically right that is not just normal. In fact, sometimes an entire culture may be blind to it. We're not talking about the normal, but the normative, that for which there is an obligation. And so I fail to see a way in which a system of moral law without a lawgiver truly makes any sense. The frequent recourse that is had by some of these thinkers to the question that natural law, if there is a natural law, would somehow be alienating. This is Sartre's problem and perhaps Kant's problem, namely that if there were a moral law imposed by a divine lawgiver, would be alienating to human nature, would somehow deprive us of human autonomy, strikes me as having a fundamental confusion about the very meaning of freedom. Let's consider that for just a moment at this point. Does freedom mean uncaused activity? If freedom meant simply uncaused activity, then I think freedom would ultimately be arbitrariness. Freedom would be chaos. Freedom would be randomness. I grant you that there's a sense in which we're free if we're not caused, but I don't think that that's really at the heart of freedom. I would rather urge that freedom doesn't refer to being uncaused, but freedom refers to being not determined by something outside. Rather, it's a matter of being self-caused, self-determined. It's a matter of self-mastery. As such, we are not saying that our free choices have no causality. Rather, we're saying that when we human beings make a free choice, what we are doing is being aware of some, maybe all, of our options, A, B, C, D, and perhaps even the option of not acting at all. And then with that mindfulness, whether we have a complete mindfulness or perhaps only a restricted, limited mindfulness of several options, what we are doing is feeling the attraction, and we can't help but feel the attraction. We're not free in the sense of we're not free in the sense that we ourselves cause our attraction to what is desirable. Rather, our freedom consists in our ability to say no to a number of the options, and then to move ahead with something else that is attractive to us. That our freedom consists precisely in our ability to negate, our ability to refuse any number of things which we do find attractive. it's still self-caused in that we have to be the gatekeepers. We have to be the ones who will say no to these things, even powerful as they may be in the case of an addiction or in the case of something where there's been a long-standing pattern of association. But our freedom has to be rendered in terms of self-causation, self-determination to be meaningful. As such, this eliminates a problem that some people have raised about there being a God in association with morality. For a God to have laid down a number of moral claims, saying, for instance, that God dislikes murder, that God dislikes adultery, that God dislikes stealing and cheating and other forms of nastiness, still does not in any way impinge upon our freedom. We are quite free to choose those things or to choose against them and to choose things that are authentically desirable. But that there is a law does not in any way preclude a freedom. It rather involves us in a much larger set of having the responsibility and the obligation to accept the consequences for the free choices that we make. Hence, I find that it is not something that is alienating or threatening to human autonomy. It is rather something that makes us rise to the challenge of responsibility and gives us a reason for considering very carefully the consequences of our actions and asking about the nature of those choices that we make. Now, with this in mind, the mainstream of natural law theory has tended to find, therefore, a way to combine belief in God and attentiveness to nature, without, on the other hand, making human freedom or the natural law obligations something that are alienating to us. Rather, natural law thinking puts a tremendous amount of stress on our innate, intrinsic end-directedness. That we are, for instance, directed toward sociability, toward looking toward the friendship of other people, that we are designed for the maturation of our own organism and the maturation of our communities. But this end-directedness can sometimes give us a sense of moral obligation without particularly adverting to the God question. But if we choose to go deeper, if we choose to study the matter further, we can well ask the question, how is it that we are so naturally attracted toward things which are authentically good for us? How is it that we find ourselves repulsed by things which are actually bad for us? This might well be rooted in the way in which we have been designed by an intelligent designer. Hence, the natural law thinker often finds that his moral theory fits very well with the notion of a divine being. And yet, it allows us, from the point of view of theory, to distinguish between the questions of whether natural law is ultimately grounded in God. I think you have to say yes to that. And on the other hand, the question of whether one needs, in the course of a conversation, to advert to God as the ground of moral obligation for somebody else to know the obligation. And that frequently there is no necessity to go all the way back to the metaphysical roots because it is quite possible to see at the more immediate level, to see at the level of what is simply evident on the basis of some experience, what the nature of our obligations are. One can see, for instance, that there is a prohibition on the deliberate taking of innocent human life, or one can see that there is a direct and immediate duty to care for one's own offspring without having to think about the source of this in God. And yet, when one is more reflective and is not immediately under the pressure of crisis, needing to make a decision, one can ask, well, what is so important about human life anyway? Why is it that human life deserves such respect? Why is it that human life might be considered sacred or inviolable? And then when one is asking those very remote questions, those very deep metaphysical questions, then I think it is very likely that one will see, because the human being is made in the image and likeness of God in a way that no other such creature is. But one needn't advert to that immediately to see natural law obligations. Let me turn in the time that remains to consider a number of possible ramifications that these questions about God and natural law have for the organization of society and culture. I'd like first to consider some matters of political authority and legitimacy, and then secondly to consider how we ought to write our laws or have our laws composed. With respect to questions of political legitimacy, some thinkers have taken a very strong stand on the questions I have been discussing, and they seem to think that we need to know the existence of God in order to recognize moral obligation. I've tried to divide that question and say we probably don't need to know the existence of God in the immediate sphere even though we do ultimately have to take it back to the existence of God. But if one takes a strong stand and say, no, to know any moral obligation, we've got to know the source of the obligation, the God who is obliging us, those people will probably have to take a stand that even human authority in government, human authority in society, will need divine support in order to be legitimate. And there certainly have been thinkers who argued for the divine right of kings, or for various forms of theocracy. On the other hand, if one is willing to say that there is a remote and ultimate dependence upon God for natural law obligation, but that one does not immediately need to call upon that, that one can instead see moral obligation without adverting to those questions, then it is quite possible to think of other justifications for a political regime, including the possibility of the justification of a regime by popular consent. Even the social contract theories, for instance, of John Locke, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and others have very much adverted to the fact that its political authority comes from human consent, from the consent of those governed. But it's a very different system, and this will also make it possible to consider how various forms of government in modernity are very differently organized, namely that we have a much greater scope and latitude for what it is that is acceptable conduct, and we regard something like religious freedom as a freedom to pursue the truth about God, which we in this country respect so deeply and enshrine as part of our law, and yet we do not insist upon a certain kind of worship as being required by the state, whereas there have been many a state before us in the course of the long history of humanity that insisted that there be uniformity in matters of religion because the authority of the state was grounded precisely on a recognition of a certain claim about God as true. There are questions, besides questions of political legitimacy, there are lots of questions about how much of moral obligation, how much of moral value we should bring into civil law. That is, it's a question about what moral obligations we should try to codify. Obviously, there are some sorts of moral obligations which it would be impossible to codify. The obligation of gratitude, for instance, when someone has given something to us or done something to us. It's very hard to imagine that there would be an enforceable law on that subject. But there's also questions about the state establishment of religion, because if one does think that there's a moral obligation to worship the true God, whoever the true God is, some figures would want to bring in that obligation into civil law, and there have been states which have had religious tests. On the other hand, many of us, I think, feel that it's probably a better thing to keep religious belief in the realm entirely and completely of freedom and never to force faith upon someone. And as such, what one must do is to say that pursuit of the truth about religion is better protected by not codifying that part of morality. If we do succeed in avoiding the temptations of a theocratic government, nonetheless, we need to ask the questions about how much of morality should be codified, because the moral law does remain consistent and does remain obliging no matter what our position is. The law, for instance, against murder, the law against adultery, the law against stealing. But how much of this can and should be brought into law? Most of us, I think, would want to say that laws against murder need to be part of the civil law, that laws against stealing need to be. But when we turn to questions of marital relations, there have been much discussion recently about how much of this should be codified and how it should possibly be enforced. It's interesting to think about the great difference between ancient and modern systems in this regard, because many ancient law codes always presented themselves as divine in origin, and they took part of their justification to be the fact that these were divine laws which they were recording. I have been arguing that part of the reason why our own U.S. Constitution has received so much veneration, has had so much of a sense of the supremacy of that law, is not just because it was adopted by the people, but because it was recognized to include all or so many of the values that need to be brought into law without, on the other hand, attempting to insist upon the codification of every kind of moral value. But it was recognized to have and to embody a certain amount of justice. A final point that I'd like to make concerns the very notion of toleration. Toleration has been an extremely important part of the modern system of government and society, but it has had two very distinct and different meanings. Namely, it arose, I think, in questions of religious freedom when people agreed for the sake of civil harmony to tolerate differences of opinion, even on ultimate truths like the truth about God, and to allow religious freedom to be codified in law as a way to respect the obligation that individuals have to try to worship truly and worship in ways that are fitting. But toleration has come to mean, in some modern discourse, not just the acceptance of disagreement, but it has come to mean even the direct approval of things that we might find morally reprehensible. This is a very different sense of tolerance, but one I think that has imperiled the understanding of the moral nature that needs to be embodied in law. A very difficult question. We'll have opportunity in the next lecture to consider some other things that law will do.